Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast half full editor. Joining me as always is my colleague and co-host, David Weintraub. How are you, Dave?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. Good. All things considered.
Exactly.
All we can ask for these days.
These questions are a little more weighted than they used to be.
It's true. You're like, how much time do you have? Do you really want me to answer? I feel so far so good. Obviously, sheltering in place. Your story a couple of weeks ago about plague cocktails was really fascinating, and obviously very timely, since I think a lot of folks have been thinking about drinks and medicinal drinks and how people have done things in the past. Obviously, this isn't the first plague that mankind has encountered, and clearly people have mixed up various...
They've resorted to...
Yeah. I was looking for the right word.
Various drinks. Yeah. I think back to the 1600s was the biggest outbreak of plague since distillation was popular in the Western world. And they definitely, College of Physicians in London immediately put out a recipe or, you know, a formula for a distilled plague water that was supposed to fix you up and prevent the plague and cure it and anything possible, you know. And it had dozens of botanicals in it, roots and flowers and so on and so forth. But it was also sweet, and you know, it was sweet and botanical. It was the kind of thing that you would take a dram of and go, "Hey, you know, that's probably not so bad." Nothing, none of the things in it were too weird tasting, so it was probably palatable, and at least it gave you the illusion of doing something.
I love that the doctors are putting out their own recipe. You know.
yeah. Back in the 1600s, what did doctors have that actually did anything? You know, wasn't that much. They didn't have aspirin. They had opium, and they had alcohol. I guess they had cannabis, but you know, that's about it.
Right. I mean, it's really interesting that, like, you know, I mean, we joke around, and certainly during Prohibition, people kind of use the term medicinal loosely. I mean, for hundreds of years, you know, alcohol was often prescribed for a range of maladies. And you know, I remember us talking about the mint julep on an earlier episode, I know you wrote a story about the julep and how, like, back in, you know, its roots go back to the UK and you know, there it was a medicinal cocktail, right? It wasn't really recreational, but leave it to Americans.
We stole the name, you know, from this medicinal drink, and said, and it was, there was always this duality with drinking as medicine. Is like, it's a good excuse to take a drink, and for some people, that's, you know, that's always been the case. I mean, people used to drink the cocktail as itself with bitters as a morning drink to tone your stomach and give you a preventative against anything the day might throw at you. You know, it was supposed to be good for your system. And that was mostly a bunch of horseshit, but, you know, it made you feel good, and you didn't have to operate heavy machinery, I guess. So it was probably a little less harmless than it was now.
And arguably sometimes healthier than some of the water that people were drinking. I mean, that's always the...
That's true, too.
I mean, some of the other options were maybe less alcoholic, but certainly, you know, had all types of things in them that weren't healthy either for you.
That's exactly true. So in the 1840s, New York had a couple of cholera epidemics. I talk about this in that article. And one of the things that was being prescribed was just straight brandy. And, you know, as long as you were drinking that, at least you weren't drinking the water, which is what was giving you the cholera. So I suppose that was okay. Although, oh, you know, I don't think you could live on brandy alone.
Right.
You might need some champagne.
Every so often, you know, a stat, you know, resurfaces on social media about how much people drank in colonial times. And what we forget is that, you know, most people drank beer or cider and they didn't realize that it was healthier than a lot of the water, because obviously the first step in making, you know, beer or cider or spirits is boiling the water, you know, and we didn't realize that boiling the water would kill all of this bacteria and germs and stuff. So that, it, you know, there's a reason why, you know, they were drinking beer instead of water.
Out in the country, the water was usually fine. You really run into problems in places like New York City when you're getting well water from the collect pond, which is surrounded by houses and, right. And, you know, open sewers running into it, or in London where you're getting it from the Thames River, which is an open sewer.
Not ideal.
If you're out in like, you know, Northern New Hampshire,
pure
probably
driven snow spring, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's not a problem.
No,
probably. I mean, there not. Might be some bear pee in it, but other than that, it's fine.
You know, I've seen a lot of people, you know, ask on Twitter or the last big epidemic, the Spanish influenza epidemic of 1918, if, you know, if drinks were involved. I mean, there's a lot going on, like in 1918.
It's funny is there that got incredibly politicized. The whole idea of drinking, there were the people who, because this was the height of the prohibition movement, they were getting the 18th Amendment, right?
Right.
The last thing they wanted was people drinking medicinally, because that made drink look good. At the same time, you know, there was no cure or anything for the influenza. And some old-fashioned doctors were like, well, you know, I'm going to prescribe whiskey, have some whiskey, it'll make you feel better. And the prohibitionists were outraged.
Yeah.
There's no evidence this does anything, blah, blah, blah. The only thing it does is kill you quicker, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other side, people were saying, you know, I went to the pharmacy and to get some medicinal whiskey and there wasn't any. What's going on here? This is outrageous. You know, well, my freedom is being impinged here. And it went back and forth and back and forth. And there was a whole lot of yelling on both sides, a sort of a depressing episode in its way.
Yeah. And we already see, I mean, you know, back around the turn of the century, a lot of those sort of fake medicines that were more booze than medicine or more cocktail than remedy, you know, kind of disappear with Pure Drug and Food Act and, you know, all this other stuff that gets passed. And, you know, the government starts to crack down on what can be called, you know, a cure or cure all, you know, so some of that's already kind of disappears. I mean, obviously, partially from public health, but also because of, you know, the dries, the prohibitionists definitely knew that that was one way that people were, you know, were getting alcohol. It was a very interesting period from the end of the Civil War, really up until prohibition, like everything is, you know, Lincoln's election was contentious because of that, because, you know, he ran a grocery store and we all know that like, back in the day where you bought liquor was a grocery store. So, you know, the prohibitionists said Lincoln's, you know, we shouldn't vote for him because he ran a liquor store. And Lincoln said, no, I didn't run a liquor store. I ran a grocery store. Yeah. You know, I was like, you know, and this debate went on and on and on. And, you know, somehow he was able to sidestep the issue of whether or not he was for or against prohibition, despite the fact that his father had worked at a distillery and he essentially ran a liquor store. But I mean, even going back to that election, I mean, it just sort of picks up steam and momentum through the end of the, you know, the 1800s and the beginning of the 1900s. So by the time 1918 comes around, I mean, it's a very contentious issue.
The upshot of it is what really makes me sad is that it was indeed hard to get a drink, especially during the second and third waves, as more and more states were dry. You know, the influenza lasted for a couple of years. It kept coming back because places opened up and, you know, suddenly here, there it was again. The problem for me is, and I talked about this in my article, is we're really talking about two different diseases here. There's the epidemic disease that kills you. And then there's the fear and anxiety and ennui and, you know, all the negative emotions that are driving you nuts while you're waiting to see if you survive this thing. Yeah. And for that, alcohol actually helps a little in moderation, you know.
Yeah.
If you take the occasional drink, and it helps you unhook the gears in your mind and slow down and relax and be a little less fearful and anxious and worried and depressed about it, you know, then it's actually performing a useful function. And when Prohibition came around, it took that away from a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that seems cruel, you know, to me. Is like, this actually made people feel a little bit better about what they were facing. And you're taking it away. And that just seems wrong.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Sometimes even for me, I really enjoy making drinks. Not, you know, sometimes even not even for myself, but for other people. Just it's that project, right? It's keeping the, you know, your mind, your hands busy, you know, you're accomplishing something, you know, there's the familiar rhythm and, you know, familiar set of motions and ingredients that you're putting together. And there's something, you know, about that that's also, you know, very therapeutic. I mean, it's, you know, people talk about art therapy or music therapy. And I don't know if there's something, I don't know if there's, if it qualifies for that quite, but like, you know, bartending therapy, you know what I mean? Like whether or not the drink has any alcohol in it, I mean, it's, there's something about it.
It's a craft, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a craft, and it gives you a little bit of control, and it gives you a comfortable ritual. As the day drags on, for me, you know, I'm thinking, well, I'm going to make a cocktail at, you know, 5 o'clock, and that's going to be like really, really pleasant.
Yeah.
You know, and what am I going to make? And you know, you've got all these pleasant thoughts there, and it's a way of sort of putting a bookend on your day. And it's a way it kind of keeps me from drinking, because it's like, right, I'm going to save it and make it really good rather than just, you know, keep slugging on a bottle of bourbon that I got in my drawer here. And it's a way of containing all this stuff and building a hedge against all the darkness.
And also, you're right. I mean, when you're at home and there's nowhere to go, I mean, what's the difference between night and day and weekday and weekend and, you know, up and down? So, I mean, giving some kind of order to the day that, like, you know, at 5 o'clock, like that's going to be, or whenever it is that you're going to have your happy hour, whether or not the drink is alcohol, whether or not it's tea, it could be whatever you want. I mean, but like, you know, like kind of demarking the end of the day and saying like, okay, that's my reward and that's what I'm going to look forward to. And that's, you know, that gives some semblance of normalcy to this craziness.
Yeah, exactly. It gives structure.
And that's, you know, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something that, you know, I crave. I think a lot of us crave as you know, as we lose control over what's happening around us, that this is at least something that we have some control over.
Yeah,
we can look forward to.
Every day brings terrible news, and it's good to have something to sort of put a wall between you and that news, you know?
Yeah.
And something to look forward to, something that you know is going to be pleasant and that you know is going to be engaging. It'll engage your thoughts. It'll give you, you know, planning out the drink and assembling the ingredients. You know, all that stuff is good. It's same with cooking cooking, you got to do it several times a day and you can get pretty sick of it.
I mean, I have to say that, like, really up until recently, I didn't know very much about the influenza plague of 1918, the Spanish influenza. So many people died, so many wide ranging effects, but, you know, it's often overshadowed by everything else going on. I mean, you have World War One, you have the beginning of Prohibition, you have the beginning of the Depression, you know, that's, you know, looming, you know, all these major cataclysmic events that just come in a row, and somehow it's been overlooked. And thinking about it, as we have in the last couple of weeks quite a bit, you know, I think it's way more important than we've given it credence, you know, in terms of drinking culture and just society at large, and kind of explains also more about the Roaring Twenties, you know, why people were, you know, it wasn't just World War One, it was both World War One and the influenza, you know, that people had survived and were grateful to be alive and to be go outside again and party. And you know, that I think must have made up so much of, you know, that movement, you know, and we don't really ever think about it.
Yeah, certainly the early part, it's like, let's just go for it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we could die at any minute. Let's at least have some fun here.
Yeah.
Let's grab for it right now. I didn't really appreciate it either. And obviously spent a lot of time studying these things. And it's interesting, you know, now to, unfortunately, now we understand the mindset a little better.
Yeah.
And I wish I didn't.
It seems all too real.
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
so you can put yourself back there so quickly, too quickly. But
you know, the other day I was going for a morning walk, and it took me past Brooklyn Hospital, and the big freezer trailers outside that they're using as a temporary morgue. So, you know, that's pretty sobering, you know, just to come across that.
Yeah, and something that I don't think any of us would have believed could have happened. But here we are.
If you told me in January that, you know, that would be my March and my April and May, what?
Yep. No, I don't think I would have believed you. I would have thought that you were crazy.
Yeah.
Oh man. But I, you know, it's definitely opened up a window I never knew existed into, you know, former pandemics and, you know, their effects upon society and culture.
I mean, I can understand, you know, I think of the rock and rye craze.
Yeah.
In the 1870s, 1880s, when tuberculosis was new and incurable.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's not nearly as infectious as the coronavirus, but it, you know, was a sure killer. And it was, you know, kind of stalking silently. And this one guy said that he had cured himself of it by drinking several times a day a shot of this thing that he made by putting 5 pounds of rock candy in a gallon of rye whiskey and shaking it around over a week until it dissolved. And those were the two ingredients. And he said it worked. And the New York Sun wrote this up, you know, just kind of as a curiosity. And within 3 weeks, you saw advertisements for rock and rye. I mean, it was a phenomenon. The article was reprinted everywhere. And because people, you know, they had nothing else. I mean, nothing else worked.
Yeah.
And I can understand a lot better, you know, the people who are trying all the crack quack remedies now, et cetera, because, you know, they're afraid, and people will try anything if they're afraid. Fortunately, rock and rye was much more harmless than most of the things, you know, injecting disinfectants or whatever that have been suggested by various crazy people.
You wrote a story about the origins of rock and rye, I guess, last year. I mean, it was a fascinating story, but it seemed kind of quaint. You know what I mean? That this idea that people believed that it would be. And now it's in fact, terrifying. I mean, going back and reading that story, it gives me chills because it makes perfect sense. I understand their mindset. I understand why people believe this. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think that rock and rye started as this, and then at a certain point it became, you know, just a drink. I don't think when we revived it, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years that people fully understood the mindset that those who, you know, who had created rock and rye, you know?
Yeah, I think people knew that it had been a remedy, but for a long time it had been a bartender's remedy for a cold.
Right.
You know, it kind of got demoted from the remedy for tuberculosis, which is a lot scarier and a lot rarer now. And so also it over the years, it gathered things like mint and citrus fruit and, you know, various
cherries,
other ingredients,
I think, yeah.
to make it seem more wholesome, I guess. You know, originally it was pretty stark, although quite tasty. I mean, I made up a batch of it, and if you like the flavor of rye whiskey, you know, it's not bad. It's very sweet.
And in many ways, it's very close to an old fashioned. I mean, that's, you know, just sort of the original cocktail. I mean, because it's, you know, it's just missing the bitters. I mean, that's essentially what you're missing. You've got the whiskey, you've got the sugar, you've got the water. I guess, you know,
there's no water in it.
No water. So you need to dilute it with a little water, and you need some bitters, and basically you have an old fashioned. And it doesn't seem like people made the jump to that either. Like, oh, like this guy cured himself with rock and rye. Like, I'll just drink three old fashions a day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there was some magical quantity inherent in just the rock and rye, it seems. But, you know, then the Pure Food and Drug Act meant that they had to stop making claims like that.
But you think around the same time, right? People are suffering from malaria and they're given tonic water, right? I mean, it's roughly maybe earlier than that, but like also seems as crazy, right? That this tree bark.
Yeah, but that actually worked.
No, but that's what I mean. But like, you know, so you're like, oh, okay. Like, look, like tonic water like works, and it's a great, you know, it's a great panacea, you know, for people to take, and it's a great cure-all. Like, it actually works. Like, oh, who knows? Maybe this rock and rye stuff does work. You know what I mean? We now look back, you know, hindsight's 2020, and it's easy for us to say like, oh, what dummies, like, of course tonic water is like, you know, would help with, you know, malaria, but like, what a dummy to take a rock and rye for tuberculosis. It's like, you know what, now that we've lived this through this, I have a way more appreciation for why people would try rock and rye.
Yeah, same. Also, you know, tuberculosis didn't kill everybody who had it, you know,
right.
So, and if you're drinking rock and rye and you feel like you've got tuberculosis and you have, you know, three small shots of it a day, that's not very much. And each time you do, it feels like you're doing something against the disease, and the alcohol kicks in with your anxiety, you know, okay. If you survive, you're at least, you know, at least you felt better.
Yeah.
And even if you don't survive, at least, you know, you feel a little better as you're going down there. At least you're trying something, and, you know, and your anxiety and fear and all that is at least getting numbed a little bit. So, you know, it's not that now, as you say, I've got a lot more sympathy for that kind of thing.
A whole new appreciation of rock and roll.
I know. I'm starting to think, you know, I should promote this.
I was going to say we should mix one up in solidarity.
That's right.
I hope a cure is as easy as making rock and rye and as tasty. But I imagine it'll
whatever
come from
somewhere
else.
I hope it comes fast.
Absolutely. I'll drink to that. Cheers.
Cheers.
Dave and I encourage you to drink responsibly always.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.